Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 19th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, Barbara Rossing will be continuing her Bible study. Today's session is number 3 and is entitled Ethics for Exiles, Submission in 1 Peter. Let's listen in.
I have 9 o'clock. Okay, my name is Barbara Rossing, and this is the third of and final one of a three-part series on 1 Peter. So we can't cover all of 1 Peter. You can't cover a lot of material in 3 sessions, but hopefully this gives you a taste of 1 Peter. And today we're going to get into the question of ethics for exiles. What about the issue of submission? I wanted to just point out, I put up on the board here, one of the wonderful things about 1 Peter is that it has within it what we think are 3 Christ hymns, 3 early Christian hymns that 1 Peter passes on and uses in this epistle. They're fairly easy to identify in Greek, but harder in English. But I've retranslated this one to show you how we do identify it. It's on the basis of all these relative pronouns that probably don't come through in the English, but all these who, typical of hymns. And you know, every culture has ways that they structure hymns or songs. Our way, in part, is to have lines rhyme at the end. In English, we tend to do that. But in Greek, what they tended to do for songs was to start the different lines with relative pronouns. So scholars think that in 1 Peter 2, we've got one wonderful early Christian hymn to Christ, praising Christ. And it's identified on the basis of these who's. So we don't know how it started, because it's just a quote embedded in a different kind of a context in the letter. I was trying to think, is there any tune we could sing it to? Could we sing it to... this is my story, this is my song, praising Christ who committed no sin. I don't think we can try to sing it, but you can at least see it probably was a hymn of praise to Christ in some way. I sing the praise of Christ, or praising Christ who committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. Who, and it's these who, which are very clear in the Greek. All these lines start with who, by who's here. Okay, so it goes, who committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. Who, when he was abused, did not return abuse? Who, although suffering, did not threaten, but entrusted himself to the one who judges justly? Who himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that free from sin we might live for righteousness? By whose wounds you are healed? Actually, this line you'll know, by whose stripes you are healed. This is probably a quotation then of Isaiah 53, you know, that that and with his stripes we are healed idea of the suffering servant, which is then picked up in several early Christian texts to apply to Jesus. And that seems to be the basis of this Christ hymn. But you know, picture, if you will, early Christians singing, this is my story, this is my song, praising Christ. Ooh, all these things. I mean, it's a wonderful hymn of praise to Christ. And there are other Christ hymns also in the New Testament. Philippians 2 has one. There are probably 2 others in 1 Peter. We find them all over. And thanks to 1 Peter, we have these preserved. I mean, this is the only known quote of this particular hymn, although some of the themes are found in other places. And we don't know the tune, of course, what singing was like. If you go to a Greek Orthodox church now, you'll see that their singing is quite different from ours, and in the Middle East as well. So it might not have sounded like our four-part harmony, but it was definitely singing. Okay, I want to bracket that. Keep that in mind, because we're going to come back to that hymn in a minute. Just to review what we've done so far, we talked the first day about 1 Peter as a book written to exiles, written to those who are par oikos, no home, or outside of their home, exiled in some other land. And it's written to constitute this group of people as an oikos, as a household, to say to those who have no home, you are at home in God. To say to those who are exiled, who are no people, you are my people. You are God's chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy people. I have chosen you. I have called you. And then yesterday we talked about that important theme of having been birthed anew, that this people who was no people, and remember, it's people plural. Everything is plural here. It's you all plural. I'll try to remember to say you all now so you'll think I'm... a southerner, but at least it'll identify the plural. You all have been birthed anew to a living hope. And we talked about how this is, epistle is very much one of hope, that proclaims hope in Christ and this idea of new birth. Now, today, what we want to look at is how 1 Peter quickly moves already in chapter 2 on the basis of that proclamation to saying to people, now that you are a new people, you all are a new people, you all are a royal priesthood, now live as that holy people. Live as God's chosen and beloved. Live as this oikos, this house of faith. And that, he spells out then the implications. One of the more important ones that we find in all early Christian communities is that it means that you are now sisters and brothers, like you would be if you got adopted into a new family. You call the other people in your family sisters and brothers. So in this oikos, in this household, those who are par oikos or exiles now have suddenly all kinds of sisters and brothers. And Christians are to call one another sisters and brothers and treat one another as sisters and brothers, as a family. Being rebirthed also means living according to the example of Jesus. As we talked about yesterday, the date of our new birth, our being born anew, was Jesus' death and resurrection. 1 Peter really says that we were all reborn once for all together in Christ, and now we follow Christ. We follow in his footsteps as we follow his example. And 1 Peter is very strong on the example of Jesus, that we who have been birthed by God now follow in the way of Christ. But this is precisely where what is problematic for some of us shines through in this epistle, as it does in no other. Because what 1 Peter says it means to follow Jesus is to submit to those who are over you, so that we all submit to the emperor, slaves submit to their masters, wives submit to their husbands. And 1 Peter has the longest section of what scholars, actually this started with Martin Luther, call the household codes, this idea of household, living as the household of God, and that it tends to be these same injunctions over and over in the New Testament of this ethics of submission and subordination. So that's what I want us to grapple with today, is how do we read that now as modern day Christians? How do we hear this call of 1 Peter, which is problematic for some of us? Actually, I hope it's problematic for all of you in some ways. I mean, if you finally come to want to say this is gospel, I hope you at least hear the struggle for others. But I'll lay out a variety of positions then on how this could be read. I should say, first of all, this is found in many places in the New Testament, the same kind of ethics. You find it in Ephesians, and this text actually even makes it into the lectionary, where wives are told to submit to their husbands. That text is read once every 3 years in Lutheran churches, all Christian churches that follow the lectionaries, and then the reader says at the end, this is the word of God. I mean, so you'll hear this. You don't hear the household codes from 1 Peter in the lectionary, but you'll definitely hear more generalized ethics of suffering. Submit when you are suffering, for this is for the sake of Christ. You'll hear these specific kinds of ethics of slaves and wives submitting to masters and husbands in Ephesians, Colossians, 1 Peter, the longest one in the New Testament, 1 Timothy and Titus. But I want to say you will never hear this in any of what we scholars consider the genuine Pauline letters. Paul never wrote this way. So when I tell staff, I'm going to do invariably here at Holden, anywhere, when you say you're going to teach on Paul, people will say, oh, I hate Paul. He's so much into that subordination. But it's not Paul that is. It's the followers of Paul. Those who picked up the Pauline legacy started to write that way. But Paul himself, in the what we consider the genuine, authentic Paul's letters that he himself wrote, never says anything like this.
What do you include in that?
The genuine Paulines would be, the first one written would be 1 Thessalonians. Then the others are 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Romans, Philemon. Did I get them all?
Ephesians.
No, not Ephesians or Colossians. Colossians is debated, probably not Ephesians. And the way, I mean, that we can talk about this in another session, the criteria for that are the language. Once you get to know somebody, you kind of know how they talk or write. And those Ephesians and Colossians just sound so very different from the way Paul wrote. Some people think Colossians is Pauline, but very few people would say Ephesians is. So I think I named them all there. But anyway, and none of those letters have anything like this. But 1 Peter certainly does. I mean, we've got to come to grips with it today. It's right in the middle of 1 Peter. It's very long. It's more than one chapter. It's longer than anywhere else in the New Testament. So let's take a look at it. In light of this call to new birth, or not a call to new birth, the fact that we are born anew to a living hope, we've been birthed by God, we have been called into being, you'll see how he moves right into ethics. And this is very much a book about ethics. So in 1 Peter chapter 2, actually let's back up and read, you can see how he makes the transition. So starting in verse 9, and then this section is in three sections. First of all, it's how Christians are to live according to the emperor. Oh, this you would find in Paul. Romans 13 has this idea of submitting to the emperor and to the government. But Paul himself never wrote about wives and slaves submitting to masters and husbands in the same way. But he does have the government section. So 1 Peter starts with the government, then moves to slaves and masters, and then moves to wives and husbands. And strikingly in 1 Peter, the call is always addressed to the under person. Probably the church to which 1 Peter is written was mainly underdogs, was mainly slaves and wives, and not very many husbands and masters, if any, because he doesn't say much to the husbands. It's mostly to the wives about how to submit, and it's mostly to the slaves. So I suppose one way to approach this would be to say, no masters or husbands are permitted to read this, because these kinds of texts become dangerous when husbands preach it at you and say, look, dear, it says right here, you're supposed to call me Lord and Master. I've got some texts that show how slaveholders also would cite this stuff and say, look, slave, it says right in the Bible, you're supposed to submit to me. But if it's only read by slaves and wives, that's at least a little different there. But anyway, let's read it. Let's start with chapter 2, verse 9, and you'll see how he just heaps up these wonderful images for who the new people are, but then how he moves right into applying this ethically. If somebody would read 9 through 17, that's the first section here. Actually, 9 to 10 is one section, and then there's a definite break before verse 11, but I'm having you read over that. So maybe somebody could read 9 and 10, and then somebody else 11 to 17.
But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy.
Beloved, I urge you as aliens and exiles to abstain from the desires of the flesh that wage war against the soul. Conduct yourselves honorably among the Gentiles, so that, though they malign you as evildoers, they may see your honorable deeds and glorify God when he comes to judge. For the Lord's sake, accept the authority of every human institution, whether of the emperor as supreme or of governors as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing right, you should silence the ignorance of the foolish. As servants of God, live as free people, yet do not use your freedom as a pretext for evil. Honor everyone, love the family of believers, fear God, honor the emperor.
Okay, so you hear a couple things there that are themes we've talked about. I beseech you as aliens and exiles, that's this paroikos idea, to abstain from the, then he starts right in on the ethics, to do this, this, and this. But he's appealing them to now as this holy people, but as aliens and exiles. And then you saw the familyhood idea, honor and love all people in the family of God, and then again, honor the emperor. A couple times he says that same thing. So this one we find also in Romans 13, this idea of honoring the emperor and submitting to government. I should just say, I don't know, probably very few of you were in our Revelation classes last week. Were any of you here last week when I did Revelation? Okay, a couple of you. This is one strategy that became probably the dominant early Christian strategy. But we have in the New Testament other strategies for dealing with government as well. And Revelation is the most strikingly different that you could possibly find in the New Testament. And it's interesting, they were written in the same geographical area. This book was probably written from Rome, but it addresses people in Asia Minor, which is Turkey. Revelation was written in Asia Minor from Patmos to address the same geographical area, Asia Minor, in about the same time. Revelation might have been written 10 years later, but they're both written in the last half of the first century, last third even, or last quarter of the first century, after between probably 75 and 95, they're both written. So they're written to the identical situation, but they take such different strategies. And I think it's really important for us to see how early Christians responded differently to the same situations. And both can be Christian ethics. I mean, there's not just one Christian ethics. First Peter is Christian ethics, and so is Revelation. Revelation says, don't you ever submit to that government. Revelation 13, it's clear. The government is a beast, an instrument of Satan. The dragon has sent this beast. Do not worship the beast. Do not pay any allegiance to the beast. Do not submit. But First Peter takes a different strategy of the way to survive as Christians and to live and thrive is to honor the emperor. So there are different strategies for Christian ethics that we see already here. But this one is the same one that Paul then takes in Romans 13. So we've got a spectrum in the New Testament.
Do you think there's still some fear of the government and still not sure what's going to happen to them? So almost they part of their developing their Christian ethic was based in a little bit of fear.
Oh, not just a little bit of fear, a lot of fear. Yes, absolutely.
You know, covering, you know, just being wise.
Definitely, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if any of you heard Ingrid Christensen's story yesterday about how it was like to be in Nazi-occupied Norway. I mean, it's scary. Of course you live in fear. Probably there wasn't actual persecution officially at this time, but there had been during the time of Nero, which was just 15 or 20 years back, not hardly one generation. Christians had been killed in Rome, and this letter is written from Rome, where they knew perfectly well that Peter and Paul had been martyred. Well, I wasn't going to get into Peter having been martyred, because that means he didn't write this, but... bracket that, yes. And they anticipated more persecution, certainly, absolutely. And probably during this time in Asia Minor, because Christians were thriving and Christianity was spreading and was so successful, there was a lot of resentment from their neighbors, absolutely. And the letter is all about the fiery trials that you are going to undergo. No, they certainly expected to be harassed. And we see in the second century, over and over, Christians would write letters to the emperor saying, don't persecute us. We're not a threat. We are not a subversive sect. Leave us alone. We are living peacefully and respectfully. Don't kill us. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. No, certainly there's a lot of fear. Absolutely.
Barbara, I think it's really striking to me as you read through those verses that you just had read aloud, the sort of contrary images of these people's identity. First, you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood. Then, I urge you as aliens and exiles, as servants of God. No, just all of these that seem almost contradictory to each other are all being applied to the same group. And last night in the forum when we were talking about fostering faith, so much of it's interesting that the same dynamic comes up about if you know who you are, then that will have a consequence for how you act, and that Christians should expect somehow to be odd. Now, so you have all the same dynamics here. How do we work this out? What does it mean for how we live as free people, yet not using your freedom or pretext? You know, that odd, difficult balance.
Right, be odd and savvy. I mean, we Christians were strategizing about how to thrive. I mean, and being smart in that story yesterday of Nazi-occupied Norway, I mean, it was a strategy of playing the cello. I mean, it was very powerful in an odd way. Exactly. No, I think we're very much strategizing here. Uh-huh.
Well, you've used the word problematic, but how are you using that?
Because the problem comes in, for example, I was just reading Zephaniah Kamita's book from Namibia, is when South Africa, for example, says apartheid is God's will, government is God's will, obey the government no matter what. Or when the Nazis said that. I mean, a lot of Lutherans, unfortunately, in World War II went along with Nazis and said, it's an evil government, but we have to submit because government is ordained by God. The problem comes when there's a terribly unjust government. then when people are told to just sort of obey, it's a problem.
And during the civil rights era, the same thing. Many churches, you know, said, as opposing the civil rights movement, that you should obey the authorities, obey government.
Yeah, even if Alabama has unjust laws, you've got to obey them, and that Christians should never break laws. That's the issue. Well, why don't we go on and read the other two sections? Slaves is next, and then wives. And then I'll lay out some varieties for how these can be heard today and different strategies now for applying 1 Peter in our lives and how we can work with this ethics or resist. Does somebody want to read 18 through the end of the chapter?
Slaves, accept the authority of your masters with all deference, not only those who are kind and gentle, but also those who are harsh. For it is a credit to you if, being aware of God, you endure pain while suffering unjustly. If you endure when you are beaten for doing wrong, what credit is that? But if you endure when you do right and suffer for it, you have God's approval. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When he was abused, he did not return abuse. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that, free from sins, we might live for righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were going astray like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls.
Okay. Did you notice the Christ hymn in there? This hymn is being used in an argument here that he's making. And how is he using the hymn? Is he praising Christ? This is my story, this is my song, praising Christ Jesus, who, although he was reviled, did not return, who suffered, who himself. Is it a hymn of praise in this context?
Instruction.
It's instruction. It's example, right? It's be like Jesus. And suddenly then that means be like Jesus, who, when he was beaten and tortured, didn't resist, but submitted even to death on the cross. And this then becomes a mandate to slaves to accept beatings, which I find problematic.
There's a difference.
There's a difference?
Yeah.
Between what?
Between Christ and Jesus and his endurance of what was happening in order for something to happen. And justification of enduring beatings.
I agree. There's a big difference. Yeah, I don't know. How many of you parents ever, when you're trying to get your kids to be good, do you use the "why can't you be more like Jesus" argument? I mean, is that... You would never use that with your kids? And why not?
Because that's intolerable. That's parenting by guilt.
That's parenting by guilt. Others, why wouldn't you say, "why can't you be more like Jesus"?
We have proven ourselves being like him.
Yeah, that's true. Even grown-ups can't be like Jesus. Well, and there's a very strong Lutheran idea, actually too strong sometimes, that Jesus died for all of us once for all. What Jesus has accomplished does not need to be replicated over and over. Because he did it, we don't have to. Once for all, Jesus suffered. Therefore, the way of the world has been changed irrevocably. Things are different because of the death and resurrection of Christ.
The question becomes, why are you being admonished to imitate Christ in this particular way? I mean, these people, I can't imagine that 1 Peter is saying, do this so that you can somehow add to import a term that isn't here, the treasury of merit. He's not saying that. He's saying something strategic about, since you find yourself in this awful situation, here's a way to make it work. There's another way we're told to imitate Jesus, which I actually did see once. some people I knew who were at the time college students had a little sign over their kitchen that said, "Would Jesus leave this mess for someone else to clean up?"
Yeah, and I think it is really important. I mean, those of us, when we are trying to work for social justice, too, we will say, let's be more like the example of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount and of Jesus who worked for change, who, as Anne said in her matins this morning, like Babe, spoke up when he saw injustice. I mean, there's a lot about the example of Jesus that is very important for us to follow. What First Peter does is pick the element of submission and say, this is the aspect of the example of Jesus that I'm going to pick out in this situation. It's strategic. I mean, he maybe knows more about the story of Jesus too, we assume. But in this, he's zeroing on this one aspect of Jesus and saying, use this as your example. And there are obviously ways that you can use the example of Jesus quite differently. Times that Jesus spoke out and said to the Pharisees, "You hypocrites." I mean, Jesus certainly spoke out at other times too. Let's see, Dan, and then Bill.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd say this is one of those times for me. It's always very interesting to listen for the hidden voices in the text, and then it raises the question about where we find some authority. But when you hear a moral exhortation like this, it's in response to something. Mm-hmm. And what's exciting or fascinating for me is quite obviously slaves, wives, people who have been in subordinate positions have been hearing the call for freedom in the text. And they're quite clearly, they are acting in ways that are challenging traditional hierarchical authorities. And that has consequences. So we don't know exactly what those consequences are, but I think part of what I need to hear in this text is also, what were people hearing in their own situations in the gospel call to freedom that now Peter is saying and not admonishing them for? But I think for me, that's also part of the voice of this text.
That's a really important interpretive thing. Every time you read in the New Testament, "do this," you can know it's being said because people were doing the other thing. Sort of, I mean, that so that we can read against the grain of the text to hear the other voices of Christians who took the other position, and then maybe there can be some back and forth as well. And as you say, most scholars would say that the household codes come in late in the first century because people earlier in the first century were hearing the radical oneness and equalness of the gospel, of Galatians 3:28, for example. "In Christ there is neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female," and they were seeing it as a community of equals, and then where they were responding, and then that was becoming rather dangerous to have all these loose cannons around, and so this kind of thing gets written. Huh, Bill?
And the ranks of the church were pretty thin when this letter was written. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. Well, they were growing, but yes, they were certainly a minority.
Really strong.
No.
Last week, the black ministers of this country went to Washington and they invited all the media in there because, you know, we're burning down their churches at a great rate today. And that story got on the front page of the Seattle paper that, hey, you know, we're tired of this. We're a Christian church and we don't want you to burn our churches down anymore. But, you know, these churches couldn't do that to Rome.
They couldn't go to the White House.
They had to kind of lay low.
Uh-huh.
So the problematic parts of it...
Right. I think it read just in the first century in that setting, it might have been the best possible strategy. It might have been a very important move. The problem is now 2,000 years later when it gets inscribed. But I agree with you. In different situations, we have to respond sometimes like this just to stay alive and as a church. I was reading, though, this book, Stony the Road We Trod. This is Essays, African-American Biblical Interpretations, edited by Kane Hope Felder. A fine essay in here by a woman, I think she's at Vanderbilt, named Clarice Martin, on the household codes, these texts, and the problem with these for African Americans and African American women is that they were used to justify slavery in the 19th century. So that's, you know, 5,000 miles away from Western Turkey, and 1,500 years later, a text is read and heard very differently. She's got a quote here. I'll just read from a guy named Charles Hodge in his essay called "The Fugitive Slave Law" in 1860. He's appealing to 1 Peter and these household codes to justify slavery. "The obedience which slaves owe their masters, children owe their parents, wives owe their husbands, people owe their rulers, it rests on divine will as its ultimate foundation. It is part of the service which we owe to God. In appealing, therefore, to the Bible in support of the doctrine here advanced, that is slavery, we are not, on the one hand, appealing to an arbitrary standard, a mere statute book, but we are appealing to the infinite intelligence of a personal God, whose will is necessarily the ultimate ground and rule of all of our moral obligation. So this then, in the 19th century, was taken as a rule for all times that children obey children owe their parents obedience, wives owe their husbands obedience, and specifically slaves owe their masters obedience, and that's why the U.S. should not abolish slavery. That's how it's read and heard in one century, quite removed from the original setting.
Our business is the servants in the 16th verse and the slaves in the 18th verse the same word?
No, it's different words, but they both are different words for slaves. Probably the ones in the first verse are not free people. They're not just hired servants. They also were indentured or enslaved. But it's two different words. Good point.
Another problem with the household code is it's used against battered women.
Yeah, let's come exactly.
The priest or pastor might say, you should submit to your husband.
Exactly. I think that's really problematic. Well, let's go on to read the next section here about wives. This one does not specifically say submit to beatings, but it definitely says call your husband master, call your husband Lord, just like Sarah did, just like the Bible characters, although we know that Sarah was a lot more feisty than that. You know, I mean, she was laughing out in the tent, and she didn't exactly submit to Abraham according to other stories in the Bible. But First Peter cites the example of her calling Abraham Lord. Yeah, and when that then is combined with what we just read about slaves submit to beatings, what it ends up with very clearly is the message that battered women hear from their pastors, from their churches, from their Bible. If your husband beats you, submit. It's the will of God for you. It's the way things are. If you endure, maybe he'll stop if you just keep submitting to that. So let's read the wives section.
Do you want a husband to read that? Or?
I don't know. Who wants to read 3:1-7? Well, let's just read 1-6. There's a little tiny verse there. Verse 7 speaks to the husbands. Yeah, you can read it, Bill. Go ahead.
Wives.
All right, hey.
In the same way, accept the authority of your husbands, so that even if some of them do not obey the word, they may be won over without a word by their wives' conduct. When they see the purity and reverence of your lives, do not adorn yourselves outwardly by braiding your hair and by wearing gold ornaments or fine clothing. Rather, let your adornment be the inner self with the lasting beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in God's sight. It was in this way long ago that the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves by accepting the authority of their husbands. Thus Sarah obeyed Abraham and called him Lord. And you have become her daughters as long as you do that, do what is good, and never let fears alarm you.
Okay. So, no fancy clothes or makeup, and call your husband Lord. But notice this appears to be written to Christian wives whose husbands weren't Christians. Yeah. So again, the issue becomes when you translate this into the 20th century, how does it apply? Because we don't have that many. It's not the identical kind of situation, but what do you do with it? And now I want to just lay out five different ways that Christians today read these texts and deal with them. I won't have you do a continuum where I lay out different positions here, but as I go through these different positions, start thinking about which one you find most appealing, or which seems to you to be the best kind of strategy, and then we can talk about the differences. The first strategy, the sort of traditional strategy heard through the 19th century and up through the 1950s maybe, is the dominant one. You can't just categorize something like that. But the first strategy would be to say that, as that slave, that fugitive slave law guy wrote, is that this is God's will for us. God has an order in mind of an orderly way to structure life where it's, you know, God, and then the emperor, and then fathers and husbands, then wives, then children, then slaves, and we should obey the one in the rank above us, all others above us, and that this is the model of an orderly society that God wills for all of us. That's one strategy for understanding this today. A second strategy, actually the next two strategies do a lot of trying to find out as much as we can about the first century situation for this, for which this letter was written, and read it specifically as addressed to them, and then kind of overhear it as addressed to us in a similar way. But try to find out as much as we can about the politics and the social situation of those Christians and understand it in light of the first century, which I think is always important for us to do. Okay, so this kind of scholar asked what was going on in the first century, what were other options available to Christians, were any of them really realistic options, what exactly is it that Peter is counseling in this situation, and who is he writing it to, and that's where we do things like understand that Nero had killed Christians indeed in Rome some years earlier, that there was anticipated to be more tribulation, although we don't exactly know what form that took, if it was systematic or if it was just kind of ad hoc. First Peter is written as an ethics of survival in the midst of the fiery trial that is going to happen to us. What exactly did that mean? And here I do think it's really important. The book of Revelation also can give us historical insights as well as a different kind of strategy. If Revelation is written at about the same time to the same kinds of settings, there too, it confirms the idea that there was definitely anticipation of some kind of very stressful situation for Christians. They were not living in easy times. And although those two books take quite different strategies, they both reflect the situation of pressure that Christians felt as marginalized exiles. So one strategy there would be to say our situation is different today. We don't live as Christians in such a marginalized, persecuted kind of situation, so we don't have to do ethics for survival in the same kind of way. A second response, or a second way of basing our understanding now on the situation in the first century was pioneered, well, actually was earlier than that, but it's most recently been done by a guy named David Balk, who notices that although it says it's an ethics for Christians and it's uniquely following the way of Christ and uses the Christ hymn to say that, the ethics itself, the conduct, seems more to be based on Aristotle and the philosophers of the ancient world. That it's very much the same ethics as Cicero and Seneca, Aristotle, Plato, everyone was promoting as a way of living in the orderly household of God. And that actually the specific ethics, when you get into it, seems to be kind of warmed over Stoicism or moral philosophy that was well known, not specifically Christian moral philosophy, but that was universal moral philosophy that then has this kind of Christianized veneer put on it. It does appear, everyone agrees that Peter has borrowed heavily from the philosophy of Aristotle and from the ideas that were very popular at that time, that this is not a particularly new or revolutionary kind of ethics. It's not new at all. It's very familiar. We can even find ways that he's quoting this strand of tradition. So, here too, you see then how it's an ethics of survival, because if Christians can say to the government, look, we're not a threat, and say to their neighbors, we're not a threat. We do exactly the same ethics as you do. We're obedient citizens. We also know and follow an ethics that is just like Aristotle's. And this is what some of the apologists wrote to the emperors, say, we're not a sect. You don't have to persecute us. We're not threatening the order. That this could, too, although a very conservative kind of strategy, was a strategy of survival. But now the question would be, does that need to continue to be our moral philosophy? Are we still bound to Aristotle and Seneca and Cicero with this Christ hymn veneer put on it? Or if this, in fact, is what these household codes are, can we take different approaches? Okay, another approach is to say, yes, there's this tradition, this would be more the perspective that those of us at Holden have really grown to love through John Howard Yoder's presentation of this perspective in this book, The Politics of Jesus, and a number of others, but he's probably the one that is most familiar to Holden, of saying, well, while it is true that First Peter borrowed somewhat from the moral philosophers, his ethic isn't the same. It's in fact quite different, because it's not just subordination like submit to the authorities unquestioning. It's a kind of revolutionary subordination. He coins this term. I think he's the first to use it. He has a whole chapter in here called revolutionary subordination. That it's this appeal out of your freedom to submit, and thereby, in a very canny, powerful way, to shake the powers. By submitting to them, that you threaten them in a very non-violent yet powerful way. This would be, someone mentioned the first session here, that this was kind of the strategy of non-violence, of Martin Luther King or whatever, of a non-violent response that somehow, while even obeying, challenges the authorities. Although we know that Martin Luther King did not, in fact, always obey the laws. There were times he said you had to disobey. But it would be this idea of you subvert the laws themselves by living in a Christ-like way, and it's a revolutionary strategy.
It's kind of like making a choice that you're empowered because you're making your
own exactly
your options.
You're empowered because you freely choose.
And that seems to be what one of my colleagues talks about, actually reading Paul, that you have to look for the print. He makes his hand up for students that says the principles versus the verses. And if you look in here for what are the principles that Peter is putting forth, and then working out specifically, it seems to me you want to go to this 3:16, as servants of God, live as free people, yet do not use your freedom as a pretext for evil. And then, I don't know what you make of this, that he seems to reverse the order of the household code, working from the most intimate out, rather than from the highest authority down?
Well, no, because he does start with the government here, but...
No, he doesn't. Do not use your freedom as a pretext for evil. Honor everyone. Love.
Oh, I see. In that specific sentence, yes. Okay.
Fear God, honor the emperor.
Yeah, but he already has said honor the emperor. Well, or he said submit to all human institutions in verse 13, whether the emperor, but yeah. Yes.
But in that, I mean, it depends on how you cut up the argument, but it seems like growing out of that, don't use your freedom as a pretext, then he messes up the hierarchical order. And goes from the inside out rather than from the top down.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, I think this has been a very important kind of approach, and still is. I think this is the one we really need to work with. The last approach I wanted to present is a Christian feminist approach. Now, of course, Christian feminisms take many forms, so there's not widespread agreement. The best place that you can look for the sort of earliest voice on this is Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza's book, In Memory of Her, where she has a whole section on this. The most recent thing, there's tons of stuff out here on this, but in the in a big new feminist commentary on the New Testament, an article on 1 Peter by a woman named Kathleen Corley presents this position. And that is that we simply, as Christians, cannot accept this kind of ethics. This is dangerous and needs to be challenged from the pulpit. In other words, that you pastors, when you come to that Ephesians text in the lectionary, it's skipped over in 1 Peter, wives, be submissive to your husbands, you've got to preach against that. That ethics is too dangerous because of the way it seems to promote battering of women, because of the way it seems to promote battering of slaves. I mean, we have abolished slavery in this country, but it's no thanks to texts like 1 Peter. You know, this text is the problem, not the solution. And that we need to take that position now even further in terms of patriarchy and challenge it. And say that, yes, the proclamation of Christ that we have in 1 Peter is important. We're not throwing that out. We believe that Jesus Christ once for all has redeemed us, and that God has birthed us anew. We are a new people. But the specific ethics, the way 1 Peter applies the principles of the Christian proclamation, applied in his time perhaps, but do not in our time, and can't be read as the word of God that we're supposed to submit to. And this would be, what this basically would be, ironically, is pulling a Luther. Because remember, I read to you the first day Martin Luther's preface to the New Testament here, where he says, what are the best books of the New Testament? I mean, he's working with this idea, gee, you can rank books of the New Testament and say some are better than others. And he indeed did that. He says, what are the true and noblest books of the New Testament? John's Gospel, Paul's epistles, especially Romans, and St. Peter's first epistle. But then he goes on to say, these are the books that show you Christ and teach you all that is necessary for salvation. Therefore, St. James's epistle is really an epistle of straw compared to these others, for it has nothing of the nature of gospel about it. And he's picking and choosing among the books of the New Testament. So if you were to say of this section in 1 Peter, this is an epistle of straw. I see nothing of Christ in it. That is, you're in a long-standing tradition there of trying to hear the proclamation of Christ. And then if you see, hopefully you not saying Paul as a community. I mean, we have to do this in community. We can't just arbitrarily as individuals. I mean, we can have favorite passages in the Bible, of course. And the lectionary picks and chooses. Not every section of the New Testament is read in church. In fact, many parts are never read in church. So the lectionary already is picking and choosing. And we can still take that kind of strategy of saying some of the New Testament is the heart and core of the Christian proclamation. We're not throwing that out. But other sections are more the application, and they are, in this case, an epistle of straw. Now, Martin Luther said that of James, not 1 Peter. He loved 1 Peter. But that would be a kind of an approach that some Christian feminists would take of saying this ethics is very dangerous and cannot be proclaimed as the word of God. So where do you see yourselves? Okay, we got hands all over. Dan, what's your name?
Sally.
David, Ingrid. Okay, Dan.
Well, I'm going to suggest possibly another lesson to draw from this, and it's that for me it's very freeing, but it also opens a can of worms. It's not so much to focus on the content of the household codes, but to focus on that in 1 Peter's community and lots of other writings in the New Testament, that clearly they were drawing on other moral teachings of their time in order to try and interpret the gospel. And for me, that's very freeing because I sometimes...
This Aristotle idea that he's pulling on Aristotle.
Oh, Aristotle. And there are other places where scholars are able to point the fact that they were trying to look at moral insights of their own time and reinterpret the time of the gospel. We hear so much today that everything in culture, everything of other teachings is bad, look only to the Bible, as if there's some pure culture-less message there. But I would say, for example, I think there's a lot of wisdom in native traditions today. I think there's a lot of wisdom in other communities that we can learn from and reinterpret in light of our gospel teaching, just as first Christians did. They heard the gospel message and they struggled with the moral teaching of their own time and they reinterpreted. But it wasn't in a vacuum. They didn't ignore moral teaching in their own time.
Uh-huh. Okay, Sally, and then David, then uh-huh. Thanks, Sam.
I have to go back behind even what we're talking about in order to interpret this, and I'm coming from a very immediate position of a church family having been abused by the authority of the institution of the church, not intentionally, but abuse nonetheless. The problem is the setting, the entire setting of hierarchy. The assumption that life is ordered hierarchically. And until we can understand, in my belief, that that's not what Jesus was living and not what he was teaching, that we can't see through what we're looking at, through the context, through the myopia of the writers, granted, inspired, but I suppose it's revolutionary. We cannot accept what is based on a hierarchical concept. I cannot. I think it's contrary to the man who lived.
And you would do that on the basis of Jesus himself,
absolutely.
Not this kind of example, but an example who says equal, not hierarchy. Yeah. Okay.
I don't see the witness in the life of Christ. to a hierarchical model when you were talking about the first thesis saying, well, this is the way God ordered it. I think we have to go pretty far back and get out from under that, including the empowering of the individual to an understanding of an immanent God.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks. David?
When I read 1 Peter, I have to remember that the whole process of canonization, the decision which books are going to be part of the Bible and which aren't, was a very human political process, and compromises were made. And I'm pretty sure that there was not an overrepresentation of women and slaves who participated in the give and take here, and who had more or less strong feelings about what was worth giving up and what wasn't. And that we gave up, you know, some people gave up 1 Peter in order to get some of the other stuff that we really like. That's how it happened. And that's also how the church is. And why we make a mistake when we think that we can only be Christians with those who think exactly like we do. That actually being Christian is to put ourselves into a community. And the reason I'm not a Christian because I like other Christians, but because it puts me into a community within which, you know, there's some agreement about what are the symbols, how are we going to talk to each other. I can make my case for what I believe with Christians. I don't even have a hearing with others.
So, and it's that sense of we, yeah, but yeah. Yet the diversity. Yeah.
We are united in our diversity.
Uh-huh.
No, and I think there are going to be Christians who are going to hang on to 1 Peter, and that's why I'm a Christian, to tell them that I don't think that's right.
Uh-huh. But I think that's really important what you said about the process of canonization. Yeah. Thanks. Ingrid?
When I read Wives in the Same Way, accept the authority of your husbands, I think maybe this is what they call proof texting, but I think of lots of places in the Bible, in the New Testament, where there are things that I would interpret as contrary to this. And I take some comfort in that.
Uh-huh.
For example, the whole business of not hiding your light under a bushel and using your talents. If the authority of your husband said, don't use your talents, don't write, don't get a job, don't be creative, don't something, I would think, well, then that's contrary to God's wishes for me. And what if the authority of my husband said to do any of the do nots, like to steal, I'm supposed to join him in stealing or something. You know, then I would think, well, there's a clearer thing in the Bible that says don't steal, so that, you know, where does the authority lie? Right? It just seems to me that this is one little place, but there's so many other places that we argue against.
Yeah, that's what I really want to get in that tomorrow, with the idea of koinonia and unity and diversity, and the koinonia even of the diverse voices in the New Testament. It sounds like many of you are already working with that strategy of hearing the different voices of the New Testament in all their diversity saying different things. And Luther already knew that, obviously. I mean, he's saying one straw and the other's, you know, gold or whatever. There are different kinds of voices, and you can use different voices to critique sections of this voice, too. So, thanks. Others of you? Here and then here. Uh-huh.
I listened to this through the ears of my daughter sitting on either side of me at church. 12-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they don't have all of this knowledge that is in this room. And so they hear this, and they hear me saying, and Tim saying, you grow up to be whatever you feel you can be and what God has given you to do with the talents you have. And then this scripture is telling them, but if you get married and your husband says no, you cannot be what God intended you to be, then what? So they are being raised contrary to what this is saying.
Yeah, and already women in the first and second centuries were hearing that dichotomy, and the radical option that more and more were taking, that I'm going to talk about some on Friday, was the option of remaining single, remaining virgins or celibate, in order to not have to live this way. And it was the sort of loose women that were considered, not loose, I mean the women who weren't marrying, who were leaders in the early church, who then got, there had to be some kind of crackdown. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's very hard to hear this as a daughter growing up. Jeff, were you there? Somebody over here? Others?
I think of this is a kind of a strategy of living in the midst of intolerable oppression, a way of maintaining one's integrity. And I think of a quote from Bruno Bettelheim, who talks about an experience in the concentration camps where prisoners were lined up to receive medication. And many of them would make up elaborate stories justifying their need for medication. And in the process, dehumanized their oppressors. They couldn't see them as human beings. He did it differently. He chose to see his oppressors as human beings and simply stated his case and received the medication he needed. So maybe it's a strategy for survival in the midst of an extremely oppressive situation, a way of maintaining one's integrity in the face of all that would deny one's integrity.
Yeah, and we talked in the first century, or first session, Dan Erlander was telling about Christians in China choosing the strategy of being sort of model citizens and kind of outshining the Maoists at their own creed of something for everyone, or whatever the Maoist creed is, I can't remember what it is. But anyway, that it can be a kind of revolutionary witness of being faithful in and obeying moral teachings more than the others, sort of it's a really powerful witness. And I think that's Yoder's thesis about this revolutionary subordination, that in your doing this, you can actually convert. And there are stories of that of winning people over. I mean, that's certainly what Peter's hoping for, the wives to be able to convert their husbands through their powerful conduct.
Do we know much about how husbands are treating their wives? Is there a response to this? Was there abuse? Was there, what do we know about that? I don't know what we know.
Yeah, I think we know pretty much. It wasn't even called abuse. I mean, husbands definitely kind of owned wives as property, basically. It was that familiar structure of patriarchy. Women did not have very many rights in that society, especially married women. But
out and out physical abuse.
Yes, parents were encouraged to beat their children when the children were disobedient. Husbands were encouraged to beat their wives. Masters were encouraged to beat their slaves as a way of, of getting obedience. I mean, there's even Bible passages that say beat your children. So yes, it was definitely a situation that encouraged that. It's the Bible against the Bible, a different Gloria.
Getting back to the, or remaining on the idea of this as being a survival technique, in our church recently we had speakers come in about spousal abuse, and one woman came from one of the leaders of a battered women's shelter, and answered some of our questions, one of which everyone seemed to have in their mind was, why doesn't she just leave? I would leave. Why doesn't she just leave? And said that in many cases, the wife has a correct take on the situation, which is, if she leaves, she's
killed.
Even in more danger.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a higher rate of death among women who leave the situation than those who stay. And so rather than telling the woman, yes, you should leave, they just try to support her in her decision because she may have a clearer take on the situation than they do.
Yeah, that's really important to say, I think. I mean, we found that in Massachusetts, that you can't just naively say, leave that batterer, because, that is when women get killed most of all. Now, I think, ultimately, I hope we can be, an oikos that provides such shelter for people and safety that we really are a refuge for everyone being beaten. But yeah, you can't do it naively. You have to do it with very strategic support systems in place. Yeah, thanks. Because they are in danger of getting killed. Absolutely.
And so that this, that supports the idea of this being a survival technique. What were their alternatives? What would happen if they had rebelled?
Yeah, because they don't get killed if they stay in the relationship, but they get killed. It's when they leave that they're most likely to be killed.
Well, the crime is that there's no other choice.
Yeah. Well, why don't we continue the conversation? Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Well, I just wondered, what about the next verse?
Which one?
Seven.
Yes, it's a little tiny verse addressed to husbands. There were apparently a few husbands in the Christian church, so they did address the... let's read that one. Do you want to read that one for us?
Husbands, in the same way, show consideration for your wives in your life together, paying honor to the women as the weaker sex, since they too are also heirs of the gracious gift of life, and so that nothing may hinder your prayers.
This is really important. I mean, this, but I guess what I would say is it's not in the same way or likewise. You're trying to say, I mean, the word likewise is definitely there. It's just like, likewise? What's the likewise? I mean, the paragraph about the wives was huge, and it says, call your husband Lord. Now it's saying, likewise, you husbands live considerately with your wives as the weaker sex. I mean, it's not exactly a likewise.
And only so that their prayers may be heard. Not so that because it's right or good or common. I mean, it's useful.
Okay. but this is, as you say, I mean, this is the Christian ethic to husbands of don't beat your wives. I mean, this is, in a society that regularly abused wives, Christian husbands are being called to an ethic of honoring women here. It does say, bestow honor on the woman. So there is an ethic here as well, a call to husbands. It's shorter, much shorter than that to slaves and wives, but it is indeed there. Well, we need to end, and I want to sing a hymn. How many of you get so you can get to one of these hymn books here? I put three copies of the belt. I think they need more up there, though. Here's a few more.
Oh, what is it?
We're going to sing number 699, I think it is. Here's one more copy. Who needs one? Well, let me just say a word about it. Well, you can play softly while I'm saying a word about it. Okay. Remember when we started at the beginning with the Christ hymn, I was saying, how did the hymn start? We don't know. Maybe it started, this is my story, this is my song, praising Christ who committed no guile. We're going to sing all three verses because the second two verses have submission in them, and see how it feels to sing about submission here. 699.
Thank you, everybody, for joining the conference.